This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program. We're going to look back over the important news of this previous week. And I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff from thetrumpet.com. I have Anthony Chibadewe.
Hello.
And Richard Palmer. He's with us via Skype from our office in the United Kingdom.
Hello.
I have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hi there.
And Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Our lead story today is high-threat criminals being released into the United States. Now, the Department of Homeland Security releases a lot of illegal immigrants onto the streets of America each year, but there are some new numbers released by Congress that are very alarming. This is from the Washington Times of June 4th. We have this article in our Trumpet Weekly this week. It says most of the illegal immigrant criminals Homeland Security officials released from custody last year, 2014, were discretionary, meaning the department could have kept them in detention, but chose instead to let them onto the streets as their deportation cases moved through the system. Now, this is what these new numbers from Congress reveal. And these numbers were obtained by the House Judiciary Committee Chairman Bob Goodlatte. And this is what Mr. Goodlatte says. Over 17,000 of the criminal aliens released last year were released due to ICE discretion. This is talking about the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. They were released at their discretion. 17,000 of them, representing 57% of the releases. This was their choice. They could have kept these people in detention, but they released them. 17,000 people, and this is probably the most troubling aspect of this. The Times says some of those released were the worst of the worst. More than 3,700 threat level one criminals who are deemed the top priority for deportation. And they're taking these people, 3,700 threat level one criminals, releasing them into the community while these people are waiting for their immigration cases to be heard. And this is an extraordinary development. 3,700 people roaming America's streets at the discretion of the ICE, at the discretion of Homeland Security, despite known criminal records. And Homeland Security officials, they say, well, our hands are tied. We have to do this. The courts say that we have to do this. This is really the one time when they're so fastidious about abiding by the rules. But these numbers from Congress show that, no, they actually chose to release them at their discretion. This is what the Times report says. ICE officials insist that those who are released are still monitored. Well, they say, well, we're still monitoring them, often by electric ankle bracelets, but also through a system of phone checks or by paying a bond. But listen to this. Nearly all of those released under electronic monitoring broke the terms of their release, according to these ICE numbers. So they put, in 2014, they put 41,000 immigrants through this monitoring program. More than 30,000 of them broke the terms of their release, and most of these people racked up multiple violations. There were 300,000 violations just in that one year, or this is like 10 violations per person. So what are they doing releasing these criminals onto America's streets? This is what Mr. Goodlatte says. The Obama administration's lax enforcement policies are reckless and needlessly endanger our communities. I should certainly say that is the case. You look at the facts, you look at the numbers, this is beyond just foolish. This is policy that comes from really bad thinking, wrong thinking, that is undermining the United States' interests. This is a story we really need to watch. Jeremiah Jacques has an article that he's writing for this coming Trumpet about this. The working title that he has is The Worst Prison Break in American History, and his article includes these numbers. During the 6 years Mr. Obama has been in power, the Department of Homeland Security has knowingly released some 195,900 criminally convicted illegal immigrants onto the streets of America. That's 85 a day on average. In 2013 alone, these releases include 193 convicted murderers, 303 convicted kidnappers, 426 people convicted of sexual assault. A lot of other convictions included child pornography charges, robbery, aggravated assault, DUIs. More than half of them were convicted of multiple felonies. Many are known gang members. This is extraordinary that they want these people on our streets. And we have another story in this issue of the Trumpet Weekly from Phyllis Schlafly. She's talking about this new book written by Ann Coulter. Now, Ann Coulter is someone that she's abrasive. A lot of people dislike her. But one thing you can say about her is she does have the facts on her side. And Schlafly writes this: Ann Coulter gives hundreds of specific examples of major crimes committed by illegal immigrants, and in particular, crimes against very young women and girls. She shows the devious ways the media conceal the fact that these horrendous crimes are committed by illegals when our government should never have let them into our country. The media cover-up doesn't conceal merely the nationality of these criminals or the frequency of their crimes. They also conceal the depravity of these crimes that are so horrific I can't bring myself to describe them in this column. This is Phyllis Schlafly writing. The United States has allowed 30 million to settle inside the country. That's one quarter of Mexico's entire population of 120 million. Schlafly says this: what do you think Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would do if thousands of Israelis were being murdered by uninvited foreigners coming illegally into Israel? If you guessed, well, give them in-state college tuition, driver's licenses, and free medical care, you would be laughed at. But that is what President Obama gives to our illegal aliens. Gentlemen, what is going on here? What do we make of this extremely dangerous policy?
The more I have looked into this story, the more appalling it is, and the more layers that are really revealed to it. One of the most shocking aspects of it was the fact that the Obama administration refused to reveal the latest numbers of how many criminal convicts it has released until it was actually sued. It was the Judicial Watch Group that filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security back in May. This was last May 2014. And only after that lawsuit were these numbers even released. So the administration's really trying to keep this on the down low. And here's a statement from the Judicial Watch Group's president. He says, "It is appalling that we've had to sue in federal court to get key information about the Obama administration's release of 165,950 convicted criminal aliens." And at the time that he made that statement, that was before another 30,000 were released in the most recent fiscal year.
I find it astounding that these people that we're releasing into communities that our own children are playing in, going to school in, are people that their own home countries won't even accept back. I mean, that's how evil these people are. That's how depraved they are. Their own countries won't take them back.
This is obviously a story that it's consistent with something that we've been following for several years and that we've written quite a lot about: the trend toward lawlessness and policies that undermine American interests that are coming out of Washington today. It really does point you back to Gerald Fleury's booklet, America Under Attack, I think, in a powerful way. And it is something that we're going to be paying for in the time ahead. I mean, this is a story that's going to grow, and the ramifications of this policy are going to impact us more and more over time. So it's definitely something that we need to be watching for. And Jeremiah, maybe we'll follow up with this story and spend some more time on it as you finish your Trumpet article. And we look forward to seeing that in the future. These articles are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. I'd encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can receive it right in your email inbox every week. We assemble this high-quality report every week. We try to get you the most significant stories, the best commentary that we can. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We're going to turn our attention now to the Middle East and to Anthony Chibodarwe. Anthony, can you give us an overview of some of the stories from the Middle East that we're covering this week?
Okay, the Pentagon released a report this month about Iran's nuclear program. Iran actually increasing its missiles program. And this is a report that was due to be submitted to Congress in January, but it was delayed for 5 months. Analysts believe that it was delayed because the Obama administration wanted to appease Iran during the nuclear negotiations. But it's just coming out this month saying Iran has been working on its missile technology, which, as one analyst said, missile technology is a litmus test to any state's nuclear intentions.
So much evidence of what Iran's intent really is. Anthony, the biggest story out of the Middle East this week, in your view?
The biggest story has been about how Assad's days are numbered. Assad is the president of Syria. A lot of reports, a lot of analysts have been saying recently that Assad is about to be defeated.
This is obviously something that we've been saying for a few years. It looks like he's been ready to go for some time, but something is different now.
Something is very different now. Assad has been in power since 2000, so he's been around for 15 years now. But the world has not been able to do anything about Syria because of the strong support it had from Iran and Hezbollah. But then at thetrumpet.com, we've been talking about the possibility of Assad being removed from power and Syria changing its allegiance from Iran. And we started seeing how that was likely to happen when the Syrian civil war began in 2011. Now we have that war. We have that war on three fronts. We have Assad regime, we have the Islamic State, and then we have the quote-unquote moderate rebels in Syria. And over the years, Assad has been by far the strongest power there. But things have been changing. The United States formally recognized some of these moderate rebels back in 2012, but they wouldn't supply them arms until September 2004. Congress actually agreed to send arms and training to these moderate rebels. So things are changing for Assad.
How much is Islamic State the factor that's imperiling his reign so much?
Everyone knows that the Islamic State is a bunch of mad people. What Assad is calculating is that if he actually supports the Islamic State, then the Islamic State and Assad will fight against the other moderate Arab rebels that the United States is funding.
He's really playing a dangerous game here.
It's a very dangerous game. So if Assad supports the Islamic State and defeats those moderate rebels, then we're going to end up with just two players. Assad, a dictator who's been around for 15 years, and the Islamic State, the terrorists who we've seen on YouTube for beheading people. So the world is really going to have those two options left, Assad or the Islamic State, and it'll be an easy choice to just choose Assad. But then unfortunately for Assad is that he's losing his grip on power. There have been a lot of analysts who have been saying that Assad really is losing his grip. There's one particular one who is normally cautious in his predictions, but he just said, you know what, it's over for Assad.
Do you remember when we put Assad's fall on the cover of The Trumpet?
This was in 2012. We had a cover on Assad, and the lead article was by Mr. Gerald Fleury, and it was about how the Syrian crisis would end. We knew that this is likely going to happen because of what the Bible says about the Middle East.
So if Syria falls, if Assad falls, then Iran's grip over this country it's really been probably its strongest ally in many ways within the region, that becomes loosened. This is something that we've been watching for quite a long time, a division in this alliance between Syria and Iran. We're seeing very likely the beginnings of that division. If Assad falls, it's over. Really significant event if that happens. And we really do need to be watching Syria closely for Assad's fall and what happens to Iran in the wake of that development.
Certainly.
Okay, we're going to turn now to Europe, to Richard Palmer in the United Kingdom. Richard, what were some of the important items that came out from Europe this week?
Yes, well, there's a couple of big stories that we're going to talk about over the next little bit. NATO held some drills in the Baltic as a deterrent against Russia. And then one of France's biggest up-and-coming politicians, Emmanuel Macron, got together with the German Vice Chancellor, Sigmar Gabriel, and they wrote an article that they published in major newspapers across the European Union titled "Europe Cannot Wait Any Longer, France and Germany Must Drive Ahead." And they talked about how Germany needs a more powerful Europe and needs a more powerful leadership. And then finally in Scotland, the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, again raised the threat that if the UK votes to leave the EU, then Scotland could vote to leave the UK.
So, Richard, what would you say was the biggest story out of Europe this week?
Well, the big story this week in Europe is Greece. It's something that's still breaking even right now, but Greece did not pay the IMF 300 million euros that it owed today. They dug out some obscure clause in the IMF small print last used by Zambia in the 1980s. So instead of paying the bill that they owed today, they lumped it all into one big payment that they will pay at the end of the month. So now instead of paying 300 million today, they will pay 1.6 billion at the end of this month. And that could have some quite dramatic consequences. At first glance, this just looks a bit like Greece has just kicked the can that little bit further down the road until the end of the month, bought themselves a few more days. But actually, there could be some fairly big and dramatic consequences from this decision. So one aspect of this that has really spooked a lot of investors is that Greece could have paid this bill, but they chose not to. And so because of this, the Greek stock market has gone down 5%. Stocks in their major banks have fallen 10%. Even before this, people were taking half a billion euros out of Greek banks every day. And that is probably now only going to increase. So it is possible that this refusal to pay the International Monetary Fund, even though they found some small print to back it up, could trigger a panic that could force Greece and its position in the Eurozone to ahead, even over this weekend, potentially, or into next week. And as I said, it's very much a breaking story. Alexis Tsipras, the Greek leader, is meeting with the parliament. And so there's speculation that he might make a dramatic announcement or that Greece may hold snap elections. And so we could see some things really moving over even the next coming days.
I have to say that with as many times as we've seen, this is a great crisis, this is the end, we're finally to the point where there's going to have to be a big decision, that you have to resist a certain amount of fatigue as an observer. What is it that makes this that much more critical than, say, the previous times where we've been in a situation similar to this?
Well, certainly I don't want to discount the possibility that this could get kicked right down the road again. I think that is still very possible. But the different thing this time, I think it's becoming more and more obvious that there, despite months of negotiation, there has been no compromise, zero compromise. Greece and the EU creditors are still nowhere nearer reaching a deal than they were back in February, last time we had this disagreement. Both sides very recently, over the past day or so, have put forward quote-unquote compromise proposals, but both their proposals are exactly the same, pretty much, as proposals they put forward before and have been rejected. There's been no progress towards a deal. And then the other thing about this time is you do have a relatively unknown and potentially radical political party in charge of Greece, and so that makes them a lot more unpredictable. And that makes investors a lot more nervous than we were in previous crisis points.
With Greece in this dire economic situation, what is the fallout, say, in the rest of Europe and especially in Germany?
There's the potential now for this to trigger a political crisis in Germany. So the central problem is Greece owes more debt than it can pay back. Up until now, the Eurozone's response has been to lend them more money so they can pay off the debt that is due right away, but they're still not able to pay the Greek debt back. It doesn't solve the fundamental problem. And so Syriza, the current ruling party, have said enough is enough. We're not going to do any deals with you until you get rid of some of our debt, because this is just silly. It's just dragging the crisis on for a very long time, and it's hurting our people. Now, you can look at this and think, well, that's fair enough, and it's very unreasonable for nations like Germany to refuse to write off Greek debt. But there are some economic reasons, but most importantly, there are political reasons why Germany is not writing off any Greek debt. Nations like Germany have turned to their voters and they've said, well, we're going to use your money to bail out Greece, but don't worry, it's not going to cost you anything because Greece will pay us back. And so if they do any kind of deal now, like Greece is demanding, and say, okay, Greece, you don't need to pay some of this money back, that's going to cause them some big political troubles. And we might be seeing this right now in Germany. There's been some interesting rumors just this afternoon, both in Bild and the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung and a few other German newspapers. And what they're saying is that Angela Merkel has reached out to Greece and offered them a compromise. Now, she's worried about Russia, like we spoke about last week. And even today, Greece's leader was on the phone to Putin, so there's good reason to worry about that. And so she's reached out to Greece. But to do that, she's had to go behind the back of her finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble. And Schäuble is much less willing to compromise. And the talk in these German press reports is that Schäuble is very angry about this and that actually Schäuble could resign. And if Schäuble resigns, that is a political earthquake in Germany. It will be one of the most serious political crises of Angela Merkel's tenure. A lot of people in Merkel's own party do not like lending money to Greece, but they're still on board with her because they trust Schäuble. Schäuble is the man that they see is looking after their interests, and he's looking after Greek taxpayers' money. And he's very popular in this role. When he's taken a hardline position in the past, the Bild put him on the front cover. And I think the headline in huge letters was something like, Germany says, thank you, Schäuble. And he's been called, you know, the savior of Germany and these kind of things by the German press when he's played a hard line. So if Schäuble does resign, like these rumors are saying, you've got the Greek economic crisis now causing a very serious political crisis in Germany. And so I think that's a very interesting development that we've not seen before in other iterations of this crisis.
Well, thank you, Richard. Coming up, we have news from Asia, from America, and later on in the program, our lightning round of important headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
This is Trumpet Hour.
We're going to take a look now at Asia. Jeremiah Jacques, what were some of the big stories in Asia this week?
Well, it was another fast-paced week in Asia. A major Japanese newspaper said that it fears that the U.S. will give in to China regarding China's increasingly aggressive claims in the South China Sea. So this fits a pattern of American allies realizing that the United States can no longer be relied upon and just realizing that we are entering into a post-American world. Another report about China this week says that its increasing belligerence there in the South China Sea could lead to World War III, and it lays out some really sobering scenarios for how that could happen. Another one says that China has developed a supersonic cruise missile, which the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence believes presents a really serious threat to the United States. This follows a report that we discussed last week about the fact that China and Russia are closing the gap with America's military technology, and some believe that this new missile really could be a game changer. Then you've got Russia's defense minister. On Monday, he said that the recent naval games that Russia and China conducted in the Mediterranean, he said that in those games, the two militaries reached a new level of profound coordination. Trumpet analyst Brad McDonald mentioned those games when they were underway and just talked about what a rare level of deep trust it reveals between the two militaries. And now this week, Russia's defense minister really made clear that that is the case.
All right, a lot going on. Let's hear now your top story from Asia for this week.
The big story is that Russia is back in Ukraine. They're sending troops across the border once again. There have already been some 25 people killed just since Wednesday and over 100 injured. So it's a really heavy outbreak of fighting there. And Ukraine's president said yesterday that his country is expecting a full-scale invasion from Russia. So this is potentially really big news. There had been a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine since February, but now that's over. And analysts everywhere are wondering what Vladimir Putin's goals are this time. And I've put together an article in this week's Trumpet Weekly, which just draws attention to the intermittent nature of Russia's sort of expansionist foreign policy under President Vladimir Putin. And it looks like Putin is following a blueprint of expansionism that dates back thousands of years. And it's a blueprint that warfare historian Victor Davis Hanson calls invade, wait, and invade. And history has shown that from Philip of Macedon to Napoleon, even to Adolf Hitler, that this is a very effective pattern. Basically, the aggressor will take as much territory as possible at a given time, and then if he sees opposition building, he backs off for a time. But then once that opposition fades, he goes right back on the offensive and grabs more. And so for Russia, the first part of that blueprint happened last year. President Putin grabbed Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula, away from Ukraine, and then opposition built from the West, from the Ukrainian government, from NATO, from the U.S., and so he backed off. But now Putin sees that America has basically accepted that Crimea now belongs to Russia. So he interprets that as real evidence that the opposition is fading. And so I believe that this new outbreak of violence could mean that the middle part of that blueprint is over. The waiting is over. And it could mean that Russia is ready to bring more of Ukraine under its control once again.
It's a policy that really takes advantage of human nature's tendency to adapt. Things go bad and you just kind of say, oh, this is horrible. And then you kind of relax and settle in and lose that posture of vigilance that, say, those difficult circumstances or those dangers demand.
Yes, that's right. It's symptomatic of human nature. We believe that a threat has sort of passed. We grow a little bit callous to it, desensitized, and we just very quickly refocus on more interesting things.
So it's no surprise that dictators and people who are trying to extend their nation's power throughout history have been taking advantage of that tendency.
Yes, it is a tried and true method of expansion.
So the United States and Western nations, they're still wondering exactly what Putin's intentions are they?
They are. I actually talked to a Trumpet contact in Kiev, Ukraine, this week. His name is Taras Revenets, and he's been giving us a lot of detailed analysis. In his view, he believes that Putin's sights are now set on Mariupol. With Mariupol, he could essentially connect mainland Russia to the Crimean Peninsula. Donetsk and Luhansk are already sort of under de facto Russian control. So if Mariupol could also come under Russian control, then suddenly Crimea is basically attached to the rest of Russia. That's what Mr. Revenets believes, and I think it is probably a likely scenario.
Well, I'm sure that European leaders are watching the situation very closely. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on 101.3 KPCG from Edmond, Oklahoma. This is our week in review. We're going to look finally at America and talk to Robert Morley. Robert, can you tell us the important news this week from the United States?
So this week, President Obama gave a speech to the Coast Guard Academy, and in the speech, he blamed climate change and drought for the civil war in Syria. So here we have an illustration of President Obama's biggest policy push being climate change at a time when the world is on fire, as the author of that article brings out. There's another item in there, an interview by a man named Ian Bremmer. He just recently published a book talking about the retrenchment of America and what this means for Britain. There's some very startling and powerful statements in that interview. Make sure that you check that out. And then finally, an article quoting Dr. Doom. Dr. Doom, it's the moniker given to an economist by the name of Nouriel Roubini. He's one of the few analysts that predicted the 2008 economic collapse, and this time he's warning about what he calls a liquidity time bomb. And interestingly, Rubini is someone that we highlighted extensively in 2006 and 2007 before his predictions proved true. And here he is out there again warning that we need to be wary. Lots of other interesting articles for you to check out the Trumpet Weekly.
Okay, what was the top story in your view coming out of the United States this week?
Chaos reigns in St. Paul schools. The schools in St. Paul have turned into a madhouse. The schools are out of control. There's reports of students attacking teachers and not getting suspended. Students barging into classes and attacking other students. Students telling teachers that they're going to kill them and no repercussions. One teacher has a secret knock that she tells her good students so that she knows whether or not to let them into their class. So this, the inner city schools in St. Paul are having extreme difficulty. As a report out this week specifically said, the classrooms are in chaos. And this comes at a time when the school board of St. Paul purposely spent $3 million to supposedly address this issue. And what we find is that instead it's turned into the Wild West in St. Paul.
How did they address the issue? What was their solution to the problem?
Well, this really gets back to the Federal Justice Department and how they have come out and labeled the schools in not only St. Paul, but Minneapolis and other schools as racist. And they say that they're racist because black students are getting suspended at rates higher than white students. Interestingly, whites, even though whites get suspended at higher rates than Asian students, but they say this is evidence of racism. They accused the 2,300 teachers in Minneapolis of having systemic racism. And the Justice Department came out and said that you need to make changes or we're going to prosecute you. That's what they told Minneapolis. That's what they told St. Paul. And these school districts don't have the money to fight the Justice Department. So for them, it's basically we're going to do as we are told. So in this case, it came down to adopting these educational standards promoted by the Pacific Educational Group. Now, this is a group that's based out of San Francisco, and that alone should probably give you an idea what this group is all about. But from what I can tell, this group, its main purpose is to sell this concept of victimization, that black students are victims of a racist white school education system. And PEG, the specific group, they say that black students will only achieve if they have specific curricula tailored to black students. Basically, it means dumbing down educational standards. And they reject, probably more importantly, they reject this concept of consequences for actions. They reject the idea that students should be suspended or there should be expulsions. Basically, discipline is thrown out the window. And now we're seeing the results in St. Paul.
Isn't it amazing? You know, there have been, say, a number of stories that have even been turned into like inspirational movies over the years of the principal who comes into a tough inner city school with a lot of disciplinary problems and lays down the law, and these students who were kind of captive to their own worst nature become disciplined. They start to achieve academically and personally. And there's something just so inspiring about that. And it's clear that it's a strong leadership, that it's the application of standards, the raising of expectations that really inspires these kids, that helps them. You know, true stories about these kinds of transformations taking place in some of the most hardened areas. Why is it that these individuals continue to insist on clearly failed policies that the fruits are so obvious time and time again that it results in more and more chaos and social breakdown and academic failure?
That's a good question. I think part of it is that it's the easy solution. Instead of addressing the hard questions, instead of looking at things like family breakdown, in Minneapolis, 75% of students in inner cities come from homes that are broken. These are kids that don't have, in the vast majority of cases, have dads in the home. In the vast majority of cases, they are single moms with multiple children. And is it any wonder that they have disciplinary problems? Is it any wonder that they're having problems in schools? Is it any wonder that there is a, you know, a school to jail pipeline? The Obama administration sees that through the lens of entrenched racism. The problem is that the white teachers, even though in a lot of these school districts, it's not just white teachers anymore, but the teachers are racist against black students, and that's why they get suspended at rates out of proportion to how many kids are in the schools.
I pray for those kids, for their protection against policies that are imperiling them and getting them more and more entrenched in this just self-destructive and community-destructive behavior.
It's really sad because these policies that are being promoted are done so under the guise of helping these children. But we see that it isn't. It's actually making things worse for them. It's like putting the rotten apple in with the good apples. What do you expect is going to happen?
This story is in this week's Trumpet Weekly. I want to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. You can receive it each week in your email inbox. Just go online to thetrumpet.com to receive a free subscription to the Trumpet Weekly.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We have so much news in our report each week that we want to try to squeeze as much as we can into our show. So we're going to give each man on our panel the opportunity to talk about what he considered his second most important news event of this week. We'll start with Anthony. The second most important news out of the Middle East.
Well, just before his election in March, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that a Palestinian state would not be founded under his watch. Now, this Tuesday, President Obama, in an interview with an Israeli TV station, said that comments like the ones that Mr. Netanyahu made will make it difficult for the United States to continue to veto motions in the United Nations against Israel. So essentially he's saying, we're not going to be assisting you more. This is going to be a lot more difficult for us to help you against the UN because of comments like that. Or Mr. Obama also said that, quote, Netanyahu is someone who's predisposed to think security first, to think perhaps that peace is naive, as if that's a horrible thing to do in the Middle East. The Middle East is on fire right now. It's burning. We have a lot of crazy people in the Middle East. We have a lot of Arab nations, Arab parties. We have terrorist groups saying we do not want peace with Israel. Essentially, the Obama administration is going to punish Israel for this. And this is something that we have been talking about on thetrumpet.com about the break in the brotherhood between the United States and Israel.
Very good. We'll turn now to Richard, your second most important item.
Okay, so the second item I'd like to talk about is that the Egyptian leader, al-Sisi, visited Germany on Wednesday. And I'll just start with a point Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry made recently. And that is, al-Sisi has the potential to be a great friend of the West. He's committed to tackling extremism and radical Islam, and he's dead set against Iran. But the American president, Mr. Obama, refuses to meet him, and he cites human rights concerns and that kind of thing. So I think it's pretty noteworthy here that Angela Merkel is very different. She rolled out the red carpet for al-Sisi. She welcomed him with military honors, and she did this despite a lot of criticism in the press and even protests there, with a woman shouting at al-Sisi himself, calling him a murderer. So clearly she's not afraid to go against the German public opinion and even break with America to court potential allies in the Middle East. So it shows a very self-confident and independent and actually quite powerful German foreign policy in the Middle East.
Thank you, Richard. And now, Jeremiah, how about the second most important item out of Asia?
Chinese hackers have stolen the personal data of at least 4 million United States government employees. So this is a really massive cyber attack. And the United States Office of Personnel Management yesterday said that they just uncovered this incident in April. It's hard to say how long it's been going on. They don't yet know whether President Barack Obama and other senior government officials were targeted. So China denies involvement in this, but the evidence against the Chinese is really overwhelming. This is interesting because Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury for years has said that America's computer dependence is our Achilles heel, and it just leaves us vulnerable. And so this report this week really shows that our computer dependence does leave us vulnerable to attack by nations that harbor deep animosity against us.
Thank you, Jeremiah. And Robert, second most important.
This story comes from Venezuela, specifically Caracas. It's a city of 5 million people. It's the capital of Venezuela. And in the city, it's virtually impossible to find an apartment to rent or a home to rent. And this isn't because the economy is booming. It isn't because the population is growing out of control. It's due to the socialist policies pushed by dictator Hugo Chavez. Just for context, back in 2003, he passed a law banning landlords from raising rents. You know, this was supposedly to help poor people that couldn't afford the cost of rent that was skyrocketing due to currency devaluation and inflation. But the fact is, this led to an almost immediate 25% decline in rental units available. So then, to solve this problem, he attacked the greedy landowners and he issued an expropriation ordinance, trying to coerce them into renting their apartments. That caused the number of units to decline by 51%. Then in 2011, he finally passed a law basically giving squatters' rights to any renters still lucky enough to be an apartment. So Venezuela's once thriving rental market is almost non-existent. Five properties for rent officially in a city of 5 million. So here we see, once again, politicians hurting the people they claim to be helping, socialism destroying an economy, implications for America, because, I mean, we see these same policies, rent control in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco. Why do we have shortages of houses in a first world economy? It's not because of, you know, free markets. It's because of interference.
A story in this week's Trumpet Weekly. The fact that ABC's World News Tonight is on the top of the ratings among news programs. It just passed NBC's Nightly News, which has been on the top of the charts for over 5 years. And there's this Washington Post article from June 1st that talks about this. How did World News Tonight manage to top out of the ratings? How did they increase their market share? Well, this Washington Post article tells the story. It says, this venerable news broadcast has slowly evolved into a newscast engineered for the social media age. It says it's brighter, tighter, and indeed quite a bit lighter than its evening rivals. It's noticeably softer with a greater emphasis on celebrity and entertainment stories and weather coverage, crime fare, news you can use, and YouTube's hottest videos. This is more and more of what makes up the content of World News Tonight on ABC. There's less world news. There's less news even from Washington. They don't even have a full-time correspondent reporting from Congress, which in some ways I can understand because Congress is less and less relevant over time. To me, this is evidence of an organization that is prioritizing its own interests and its own ratings and its own numbers and its own bottom line over the interests of the people. And people, they want celebrity news, they want light fare, but they need, you need the important news of what's going on in the world. That's why you need this program. That's why you need the Trumpet Magazine. That's why you need the Trumpet Weekly, because we're not covering firefighters rescuing cats stuck up trees. We're not covering celebrity news. We're talking about important news, important events that are happening in the United States, in countries around the world that really are going to have a massive impact. The world's news organizations are putting their head in the sand because they want to make sure that they're giving people what they want. But all of us have to really take a strong look at what is happening in this world and understand its significance and see what truly is important in absolute terms, rather than just kind of going to the nearest shiny object that arouses our curiosity. Jeremiah, you had a comment about this.
Yes, at the beginning of the hour, you discussed criminally convicted illegals being released onto the streets of America. I looked at World News Tonight's archives to see if they had reported on that story the night that it broke. And it was back on March 18th when the latest release criminal figures were published. And World News Tonight spent quite a bit of time that night informing the country about President Obama's completion of his bracket for the men's NCAA basketball tournament. They also spent almost 4 minutes discussing ABC's rendition of The Sound of Music. But regarding the thousands of convicts roaming the streets, World News Tonight was totally out to lunch.
I'm Joel Hilliker, and this is Trumpet Hour. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. I'd encourage you to go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we've been talking about in this program today is in this report for this week. We have links to Trumpet articles that provide more explanation and give greater insight and analysis into many of these stories. You can even get a free subscription to our monthly news magazine, the Philadelphia Trumpet. You can receive this high-quality news magazine 10 times a year at absolutely no cost to you. Please send us your thoughts. Send us your questions by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. You can follow us on Twitter @thetrumpet_com. You can find us on Facebook and Google Plus. Just search the Philadelphia Trumpet. I want to thank my guests today, Anthony Chibataway, Richard Palmer, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Great to be with you.
Thanks.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I want to leave you with the words of Franklin P. Jones. He said, "Honest criticism is hard to take, particularly from a relative, a friend, an acquaintance, or a stranger." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.